Wyatt. I'm Bob Rankin. I am state representative for District 57. I've been in office for 6 years, and I'm running for my last, I'll be term limited this time, so I'm running one more time.
What are the biggest issues facing your district?
Well, thank you. I'm working this summer on what I think are the three biggest issues. I asked for and got an interim committee to look at the Gallagher Amendment and its effect on our taxing.
And that, the Gallagher Amendment is a complicated thing to explain.
It's a complicated thing to explain. I'd be glad to try.
Let's give it a try.
All right. But it would affect our fire districts, counties. The Gallagher Amendment was the result of an amendment put onto a bill in 1982. And it went along pretty good, but along came Tabor in 1992. And the two working together have an interesting effect.
Yeah.
So Gallagher causes residential property taxes to go down in order to maintain a ratio between commercial or non-residential and residential rates. Now, the problem is that it says in the Constitution that calculation is statewide. So when property values start to go up in Denver in the Front Range, as they have, then that causes, Gallagher causes the rate for residential property to go down.
So in other words, property owners here, or in other words, people on the Western Slope, are kind of held hostage, for lack of a better term, by this ratio that development and growth on the Front Range is kind of is throwing off for Western Colorado.
Exactly. And I asked Senator Gallagher, who came and testified for our committee this summer, I said, Senator Gallagher, when you were talking about this in 1982, did you consider the disparate impact that would occur on urban areas and rural areas? And his answer was, no, but we should have.
Yeah.
So we're faced with this thing where, if you think about it, our assessment for our residential property does not go up near as much as Denver. It does go up a little bit. So if you're a fire district and all of your revenue comes from residential property taxes, you would lose 23% of your revenue over two Gallagher resets. We have fire departments, they're off selling fire trucks and closing stations. We can't let that happen. Look at the heroes in our own valley putting out the basalt fire. We can't let them take that kind of hit.
Right.
So what I've been working on, and I was able to, I requested an interim committee to look at this. I had 47 legislators back me up, but only one legislator can actually be the requester. We had the committee, we met four times, and we have voted out three bills that will go to the legislature. And we have bipartisan support, which I'm really happy with. We have support from Republican, conservative folks on the Front Range who know that they're taking a risk with their own property values, but they're willing to step up and help. This is great. So we'll be going to the ballot next year, 19, if the rest of the legislature goes along with the committee. We'll be going to the ballot in November of 19 to repeal the Gallagher Amendment, just repeal it. We have another bill that replaces it, but on a regional basis. So we will still protect residential property owners from those escalating taxes that was the original philosophy in 1982.
Okay.
But we'll do that on a regional basis now, and it will be statute, not constitution.
In other words, and the difference between those, explain, please, for the listeners.
If it's in the Constitution, the legislature has no control whatsoever. It's on autopilot. So these constitutional amendments, Tabor, Gallagher, Amendment 23, they don't work together. Hmm. And when the people that pass them or vote on them, and there's some on the ballot this year, it's a mistake, in my opinion, to put budget issues in the Constitution. That ought to be the responsibility of the legislature. And mm-hmm. if we don't do it the way you like, don't vote for us. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. the way it's supposed to work. But yeah. instead, our hands are tied. I'm the senior member on the Joint Budget Committee. Our hands are tied in so many ways. We still can do some good things, and we have. But we need to unwind these constitutional constraints on what the legislature can do.
Yeah. So not to get totally into the weeds here, but the relationship with the taxpayer Bill of Rights. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Tabor basically requires that any time that the government wants to raise taxes, it needs to be approved by the people. The constituents need to agree to it. So basically, any time that someone has a tax proposal, a mill levy or what have you, they need to ask the voters to do so. The problem with that is, at least in some cases, is that people don't want to see their taxes go up. Is Tabor a good idea?
Well, there are two different parts of Tabor. One of them says that anytime you raise taxes, you have to go to the voters. Most people in Colorado like that philosophically. The other part of Tabor says that you can only grow government spending by a formula which has to do with population and inflation. So those are two different aspects of Tabor. Now, the part that works with Gallagher is, so Gallagher causes the rates to go down. And if you're a local fire district, if you would like to keep your revenue flat, you'd have to run an election. We're talking about thousands of these special districts across the state. So what we need to do at the state level is repeal Gallagher, first of all, so you don't force taxes down. And then we start where we are with taxes.
We start at the current assessment rate.
We would start at the current assessment rate and let the local, regional, and we need to define what those regions are. We have a proposal, but we need to work on that. The region would decide whether it wanted to raise taxes. They could lower the taxes without a vote of the people, but they couldn't raise them unless they went back to the people.
Okay.
So, but if we start where we are, then we don't have that continuing impact where Gallagher forces it down and Tabor won't let it go back up without a vote. That's what we're trying to overcome.
Gotcha.
Now, we're not repealing Tabor. We know that a repeal of Tabor or even a major change of it is not popular. It probably won't. The voters would not approve it in a ballot measure. We know that. But we think that the stage is set for repealing Gallagher, at least get the complications of that part of it out, step at a time, you know.
What are the other issues that are facing your district?
Well, the health care. We have the highest cost. If you go out to buy an individual insurance policy, you will pay some of the highest cost in the nation.
Why is that?
Well, the state has divided itself into 9 regions and calculates differently what the rates would be in each of those. And the insurance companies then come in and negotiate with hospitals based on those cost calculations. So that's part of it. So there are really two things that we need to work on. One is that we have a very unfair situation. We pay 40% more than the Front Range. The other one is the underlying, you know, long-term tackling of cost and transparency of cost.
Yeah. So we pay 40% higher, costs that are 40% higher than those on the Front Range, because there's a lack of competition, because there are fewer providers. Why are the costs so high?
Well, those are both contributing factors. To a large extent, you know, we don't actually have enough transparency to know. And we're working on that. I ran a bill last year, it didn't pass, to get transparency of hospitals. I pushed and set up a group in our own department to use Medicaid, because we can capture the costs there, to find out where those cost factors are. We have a plan in place. It's 3 to 5 years. And working with a consortium of the hospital association, doctors, everybody, to try to get at that. I think we'll make some progress, but that's a longer-term deal.
Yeah.
Short-term, I'd like to fix this disparity, and I've run a bill to have one insurance rate statewide. That would cause our rates to go down about 30% However, the rates on the Front Range would go up 5%. So I didn't get it passed. You know, I mean, we're outnumbered. There are only 12 legislators in the whole out of 100, House and Senate, who actually represent Western Colorado or rural Colorado. So these are uphill fights. It takes a lot of persuasion.
Was the Affordable Care Act a good thing for Western Colorado?
It hasn't worked out well. And it's really because it's a complication of Medicaid, Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act caused a lot of mandatory requirements in insurance. And so the insurance companies don't have a lot of flexibility in designing programs like for our region. So that has definitely been an impact. Right now we have one insurance carrier. We have, you know, like 27% of the people in the state are on Medicaid. So they move off Medicaid, they go into the exchange. There's only one insurer. It's extremely expensive. So what's happened is, and by the way, we're moving a lot of people off Medicaid. The economy is good. But as they move off Medicaid, then they can buy this subsidized insurance on the exchange, but it's expensive. We get too many people, as they start to make a little more money, are going without insurance. That's the segment I'm concerned about.
So they're basically their incomes are raising enough such that they're not eligible for Medicaid, but the options that they have for private health insurance are too expensive. There's still too much of a gap between those two.
Right. And so you when you come off Medicaid, you go to the exchange, right, to buy insurance. You get a subsidy, but that subsidy decreases the more money you make. Mm-hmm. So we're finding out, so Medicaid cuts off at 138% of the poverty level. We're finding people who start to make about 200% and up. In 400, you get no subsidy at all. We're finding too many people in that range who are going uninsured, and that's a concern. We need to find a way to do that. I have a new idea I want to run with in the next legislative session.
What is it?
Well, what I want to do, I think the insurance company should have a product that's just catastrophic insurance. It would be much less than you currently pay.
The premiums would be much less.
The premiums would be much less. But then, how do you deal with your doctor? Everybody needs a primary care doctor. So there's something called direct primary care. You pay per person per month. It can be as low as $50. And you don't deal with an insurance company. You go directly to a doctor and buy this service. I would like to do a tax credit for that, so that we help folks a little bit with what that cost. But then they have somebody to manage their health care. And we know that if you can combine a little bit of that with behavioral health access, mm-hmm. then what you've got is a situation where people don't go to the emergency room, their care is carefully managed. You know, it would work. It would really get a lot of these uninsured folks that I worry about, with some coverage.
Yeah. So one thing that, and I don't mean to kind of stick on this. We can move on in a second. But
no, it's good. One of my favorite subjects.
So one thing that the Affordable Care Act did is it did expand Medicaid, and
yes.
more and more people, especially in Western Colorado, finally had health insurance. Was that important for your constituents?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. There are a lot more people who have Medicaid, but then, because of the other issues that we've talked about, there are a lot more people who are just above Medicaid who are going uninsured. So we shifted the issue. We did. And by the way, you know, the state only pays providers about 70% of the cost of Medicaid. So where do they get that other 30%? They shift it to the cost of private insurance. You ask about why it's so expensive. That's one of the reasons.
Next issue. What's on your mind as far as House District 57?
Ever since I've been there, I've been concerned about equal opportunity for our kids, schools. And nobody believes that rural schools have the same opportunity as, you know, urban schools. I mean, it's just true. And
it's true that they don't.
It's true that they do not. And it's the funding formula, which is not always fair. It's very erratic, but it's not always fair to some of our rural schools. And the other issue is just community resources. We're really lucky. I mean, the Roaring Fork Valley, we've got, you know, a couple of hundred nonprofits. But that's not true everywhere else. And, you know, kids are only in the K-12 kids are only in school about 20% of the time. So when there are a lot of resources for after school, maybe that fifth day if they're on a four-day week, the big difference in what their exposure and opportunities really are. So I've been really concerned about that. I co-chair, about a year ago, we went to the governor, several of us, and asked for an executive order to set up something called the Executive Leadership Council. What we're doing there is re-envisioning what education ought to be, from early childhood all the way through retraining for people like me, you know, maybe retrain.
People basically who are looking to get into a new field of work.
Right. Leaving life as an engineer and becoming a politician, you know. You need training, believe me, to do that. So, but education is the other thing that I really worry about. It's funding, it's and teacher pay, you know. Teachers complain about being paid enough, but it's so, there's a big difference in where you live and what you need, you know. And I mean, teachers mostly are happy with their jobs because it's a good job. I mean, I would enjoy doing it, but you know, we really have to look at compensation, respect, training, preparation, so many things in the teacher spectrum that we're looking at in this vision work we're doing. What we hope to be able to do, and we're just publishing that right now, we've been at it for a year, we've reached out to all 178 school districts, around 100 advocacy, believe it or not, there's about 100 organizations in Denver who advocate for education in some way or another. So we reached out to all of them. We did a survey. We had 6,000 responses. So we're putting all that together in a vision document. I think that's what we ought to be talking about in education. Education is not doing what it needs to do when you look at the fact that only 40% of our kids can read at third grade. I shouldn't say it exactly that way. They don't pass the test to read at grade level.
Gotcha.
When we send kids to college, 40% of them need remediation. The workforce continually says we're not training people in the right way for the job market. A big issue right now. We know early childhood is disorganized, and many of our kids go to kindergarten unprepared or first grade. So those issues we really need to understand where you can make a difference.
Yeah.
Where are the big silver bullets that can really help?
But wouldn't you say they're arguably more kind of immediate concerns than out-of-the-box thinking, changing the system, changing the education system? I mean, you had hundreds of thousands of teachers who descended on Denver earlier this year to say, we're not being paid enough. Are they being paid enough?
You know what? I'm on the Joint Budget Committee. I've advocated for more money on education. We increased the K-12 budget 10%. Two of that was a benefit through PARA, where we bought down the PARA thing. 8% was absolute money into the system. So I asked the teachers, did you get an 8% raise? Where'd that money go? So here it is. I mean, it's like 2 days after we do that, we get 1,000 teachers yelling at us. Is that right? And we can do good again next year. We can put more money into education. I mean, we put $666 million more dollars into K-12 education than we had the year before.
Yeah.
And what did we get? We got teachers protesting that we're not doing anything. I mean, I don't mean to sound defensive about it, but look at what we're actually doing.
But nonetheless, I mean, the Colorado's per pupil funding is one of the lowest in the states. I mean, education statistics across the board.
For years, I've been told that. For years. Go look at, so they talk about the, quote, negative factor. Negative factor is $672 million. What they never talk about is local mill levy overrides.
Okay,
we have to
define these terms because no one knows what we're talking about. Then what is the negative factor?
The negative factor results from Amendment 23, which said that school budgets should grow by inflation plus population plus 1% up until, I think, 2016. And then now it just grows at population. So it constitutionally said that that the budget should grow. Years before I got there, in the Ritter administration, they created something called the negative factor, which said that, okay, we will calculate what a school district should get based on Amendment 23, and then we will subtract from that the negative factor, which acknowledges that we don't have enough money. So that's what the negative factor was. There was a decision by the Supreme Court 2 years ago that said we are interpreting it properly when we look at the growth of base funding and not the so-called categorical funding. In other words, what we've been doing with a negative factor was ruled constitutional by the Colorado Supreme Court. So currently today, and we put last year, we subtracted $150 million from the, quote, negative factor. By the way, we changed the name. It's no longer the negative factor. It's now called the BS factor, the budget stabilization factor. You might want to apply a different name to it. So today, as going into this year, that factor is $672 million, $150 million less than it was the year before. Now, let's talk about local mill levies. Many districts, most districts in the state, have compensated for that factor, for that negative factor, by running local district elections. And this goes back to what we talked about earlier.
With Tabor.
Yes. You can run a local election. So they run a local election, say we need more money for schools. So over time, that number has grown. If you add up all of the local taxes that are done that way, it's $1.2 billion. There's another full $1 billion on the ballot this year. So let's add all that together. Let's take those local taxes and the state taxes, and let's talk about the total tax contribution to the state system. We're not 52nd in the nation. No, I often say we're not 52nd.
You know? Sure. Fifty-second of all fifty states,
right? We're not. We're somewhere in the middle of the states, you know. And so there's been this, I call it a myth, perpetrated over time, that we're so far down. I don't really believe that. There are a lot of different ways to calculate where we stand. You can look at the per pupil comparison. You can look at our contribution as a percent of our total state income. You can look at it a lot of ways, but I'm a skeptic about all those numbers.
Okay.
Secondly, the legislature, the budget is really good last year and this year, surprisingly good because of the economy. We did great things last year, 10%. We can do more this year. I believe that we will continue to really support education in K-12. Same time, I want to do this vision work. I want to tell people what they can expect to get for their money.
Mm.
That's my problem with just asking for more money, is that we need to be able to communicate to the people in the system, to the students in the system, to the parents, to the taxpayers who don't even have kids. We need to tell them what they're getting for their $7 billion a year.
So we went into a lot of different topics there, and I just want to ask you point blank, for teachers who live in the House District 57 who teach in your district, are they paid enough? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. If one of the primary concerns for teachers is I can't afford the cost of living, I work a 60-hour week, I'm paying out of my own pocket for school supplies. How are you going to help solve that problem?
Well, isn't that the same question you asked me previously about, do I think they're paid enough? We're going to continue to put more money into education.
But from where?
From the general fund budget. I'm telling you, last year we had $1 billion that we didn't expect to have. This year we've got additional money. The economy is really, we're up against the Tabor limit. We're going to be doing a Tabor refund. But that gives us flexibility in the budget. So we will be working hard to continue year over year to increase the school budget more than inflation. That ought to help the teachers. Now, we've also got the ballot initiative. We don't know how that 73, we're not sure how that's going to come out. That could change this equation. But even if that doesn't pass, you know, I think we'll be working on this problem. I mean, everybody knows about it. I mean, it's, you know, I can argue over where we stand in ratings against other states. It's sort of irrelevant, you know. I mean, we really need to listen. We need, and it's a regional thing. It's a district thing. Some districts, it's housing. You know, some places it's cost of living, you know, groceries. So it varies across the state, and we have to take that into account. That's always been my issue, is that to have equal opportunity for all our students, we need to look at unequal factors, you know, geographic, economic factors throughout the state. I've worked hard on teacher recruitment. I passed a bill last year to have a $10,000 stipend for teachers in their senior year to actually be to do an apprenticeship in at the district. I ran a bill to relieve student debt for teachers. So we'll continue to do some targeted things like that, and at the same time look at the overall budget.
Great. Let's talk about energy. You in a recent debate. A recent sort of, I guess it was kind of more of a town hall. You self-identified as an unabashed supporter of the extractive industries in your in House District 57. So one of the things in front of voters this November is Proposition 112,
right,
would increase the setbacks. Basically, new oil and gas development would need to be 2,500 feet from occupied structures, meaning houses and schools and so forth. Does oil and gas development pose a public health problem?
Well, I assume it could. We have the strongest regulations in the United States in Colorado. We've done extensive measurement. The department has done extensive measurement of actual, you know, contaminants in the air. We've looked at health effects, so I think we're doing the best job in the United States, really, in addressing those issues. I mean, to address your other point, I agree with Congressman Polis and Governor Hickenlooper and Governor Ritter and almost everybody else who's really knowledgeable of the situation that this is the wrong thing. It would, in fact, devastate the industry. On the other hand, you know, I don't think we should stop looking at the effects on safety. You know, look at the Firestone explosion. I mean, that was when
an abandoned flow line
exactly
right. Made a house explode and killed two
people. Safety is important. I think we need to look at variable setbacks from schools and you know sensitive areas. You know, our problem out here though, it's hard to really understand what this is like on the Front Range for us. I mean, you know, these subdivisions and oil fields are close together. And there's a lot of issues. We need to be sensitive to the concerns of those folks, and I think we are. I think that my responsibility, look, I represent the Piceance Basin, second largest deposit of natural gas in the United States. I represent three coal mines. I don't care how strongly I feel, and I do feel strongly, that we should evolve over time to more renewable energy, as much as we can, given that we don't put too big a burden on taxpayers as we do it, right? I believe that. At the same time, I represent a lot of people whose livelihood and certainly property tax base depends on oil and gas. So it's my job to be their representative in having a long-term plan that protects them, their jobs, and their communities, at the same time being sensitive to climate change. And, you know, I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I have to walk the line. I mean, that's my job.
Yeah.
You can't represent this district unless you do.
Yeah.
Walk the line and be sensitive to both sides.
Can I ask, though, I mean, the 2,500-foot setbacks only apply to private land, right? Garfield County is over 50% public land. So,
yeah, but the drilling is 90% private.
You're exactly right. I just wonder, there's all this public land to go drill on. It's not as if the Piceance Basin doesn't sit underneath a bunch of federal land. What's to stop oil and gas companies from just applying to drill on federal land?
Are you advocating more open leasing and drilling on public lands? There's a huge controversy, I mean, opposition to that. I mean, my gosh, there's gas under the Thompson Divide. So, yes, I would advocate more drilling on public lands.
And so the concern though is that and I've spoken to several who are against Proposition 112, and it's that that drilling that the process of trying to drill on public lands is too burdensome. Do you believe that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I wonder, you know, at what point would, what kind of scientific evidence would you need to see to convince you to vote for Proposition 112, to basically agree to these 2,500-foot setbacks? What kind of proof would there need to be?
Well, there's been a lot of work already done. I suppose we could be skeptics about whether that's valid or not, but there's no proof that that the actual health issues are affected, you know, very differently between 500 and 2,500 feet. I don't believe that. I think there are other issues. You wouldn't want one of these things, next to your house. By the way, it's only a few months. You know, we had a huge controversy I've been very involved in out in Parachute, and the drilling's done, and there are a couple of pipes sticking in the ground. You know, I mean, so it's a fairly short-term thing. So I think the other factors, odor, sight, those kind of factors, trucks coming around, have been discussed greatly. I am not convinced that we can improve the health of citizens by moving that setback back. And people talk about horizontal drilling. Yeah, that's amazing, technology. But you can't just move 2,500 feet back because there's another building, and, particularly on the Front Range.
Right.
I mean, you don't, there's just nowhere to drill from if you, and so I don't think you solve the problem with the 2,500 setback. I do think setbacks should be flexible, and they have been. There is a mechanism for the county, locally designated representative to get involved and work on those issues.
And for the COGCC, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation, to grant variances and to let oil and gas companies drill even closer.
Yeah, there have been some of those. Yeah, right. Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
The area you represent is so dependent on oil and gas revenue. How do you work to diversify rural economies such that they're not completely and totally beholden to natural gas prices?
It's interesting that our jobs in Garfield County, for example, are not solely dependent. There are a lot of other, in other words, tourism is much stronger, as is a number of other industries, but our property taxes are. So there's a difference between jobs and property taxes. In Garfield County, about 50% now, used to be higher, is property tax from oil and gas. Rio Blanco, it's 80. So that's, and half of that goes to schools. So if you suddenly, precipitously close down, oil and gas, you're gonna really hurt property taxes. It won't hurt jobs as much. So, how do we go? How do we diversify our economy? Well, it's easy to just say we should, but I've been working on this for years, and we have a very aggressive economic development team at state level who talk a lot about rural and who really work on this. So it's not, from a jobs point of view, we're doing pretty good in diversifying. I don't know how we get away from property tax values. We've learned to live, We've kind of learned to live with, good times. Although it's off now, we've got good reserves in Garfield County, Rio Blanco County, because of that. Rio Blanco County has the best broadband structure in the state, and they were able to do it because they had money to spend along with state money coming in. So those kind of things are really, really advantageous to our counties. I don't know how we do that. We have to look at it really on a longer-term basis. I don't see any immediate replacement for property taxes from oil and gas and coal.
I guess I just wonder, when you think about economic diversification, when you think about creating a more stable economy for your constituents, what are some of the main ingredients that are going to go into that?
I like to think about it as infrastructure. Let's say you wanted to move to Colorado, right? And from somewhere, you got a few little kids, and so what do you want? You want an interesting, dynamic job, but you want a few other things. You want to be able to educate your kids in a school that will give them every opportunity. So if you want them to go to Harvard, then you want them to have an equal shot at that. You don't want your health care to be so expensive that you can't afford to live. You want to buy a house that you can afford to live in. You want a variety of housing options, put it that way. You want transportation. You want an airport. You want roads. So those things are infrastructure. So right now, if I wanted to locate my small business here, I would look at that. You know, our school, RE1's pretty good. RE2's struggles 4 days a week, you know, at Scarfield County. And you'd look at the tax structure. What are you paying for taxes? So all of those things are things we can work on. Healthcare, big deal. I mean, people are moving away from here because of the cost of healthcare. So that's high on my list. Broadband, I think our county, working with Pitkin County, has a great plan in place. We're about to do something that would equal, we're talking about gigabit speeds, you know, for under $100 a month. That's good stuff. That's what we're doing in Rio Blanco County. So we have to do that. That's infrastructure. CMC, Colorado Mountain College, doing a pretty good job. You know, they're doing some four-year degrees. They're taking care of our DACA kids, you know, and that's very important to us and others, you know, the documentation issue. So infrastructure is where the state ought to be. That's what I ought to be thinking about, because we're not going to just go get the next small company to come here. And again, we go back to property taxes. I mean, you know, that we still have that issue. Where's our revenue coming from?
I mean, you mentioned the DACA students, and I guess I just ask you, is there anything that you can do at the state level in terms of kind of protecting undocumented people here?
That's so hard. I mean, we can certainly lobby the federal government, you know, and our own congressmen and senators, and I have. So I think we can lobby the feds. We did do in-state tuition for DACA kids. A lot of it just comes down to what we can do on an individual basis, I guess. One thing I worry about is our kids. You know, the kids in our public schools here are 90% citizens. I mean, they're not undocumented, but their parents are in many cases. So the parents are afraid. You know, they're afraid to get involved in the school. They're afraid to enroll their kid in Medicaid, which would be a tremendous boost to getting health care coverage, because they don't want to get involved. You know, they're afraid of getting into the system. Somehow we have to do everything we can to make these people feel safe. We need them. We need their labor. We have below 3% unemployment. We need to have them in jobs, paying taxes, contributing, and they don't in a lot of cases, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know the answer. I mean, look, U.S. Congress has wrestled with us through two administrations and played political football with it. I mean, I can't fix it.
But a lot of these people are your constituents.
They absolutely are. And I feel like they live here, you know, and I feel like it's my job to try to take care of them, represent them as best I can. I just don't see anything on the state agenda, certainly nothing I've heard about recently, that's going to help the situation. I mean, I'm open to ideas. Tell me what to do. I mean, you know, a lot of people do. I think I'm open to input, but it's a frustrating situation. I mean, I'd like to say I believe in the rule of law, but the law needs to be changed.
Representative Rankin, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Wyatt.